Welcome, everyone, to the Ottawa Law Review's inaugural podcast. My name is Olivia Folletti, and I'm a senior editor of the OLR.
My name is Alex Sibley. I'm another senior editor at the OLR.
And we're very excited to be sitting here with Ottawa's very own Adam Dodek, who was recently elected as our dean for the Faculty of Common Law English.
Well, thank you very much, and it's a great pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to taking over leadership of the Common Law Faculty on January 1st, 2018.
Wonderful. We're so excited to have you. Professor Dodek is a constitutional law expert as well as a legal ethics scholar, and today we're going to be delving into that a little bit with him.
And we're very excited to have a constitutional law expert like Professor Dodek here with us because the OLR will be publishing a Constitution 150 special issue coming shortly. So that's great.
And as we are a bilingual law review, a transcript of this podcast will be made available in French.
And audio equipment and technical assistance today was provided by Zoom Productions. And we would also like to acknowledge that we are here at the University of Ottawa, which is on unceded Algonquin territory.
All right, let's get into the questions.
Super.
Professor Dodek, you have written extensively and regularly about the Canadian Constitution. You not only wrote a book entitled The Canadian Constitution, but you are a spearhead of the Constitution 150 conference in March 2017. In your view, why should Canadians care about the Constitution?
Well, thanks very much for those questions, and it's been great to be able to work with the Ottawa Law Review over the past few years and look forward to continuing to do that. Why should Canadians care about the Constitution? I mean, first of all, there's the obvious point that the Constitution is fundamental law that governs all of us and sets the ground rules for how law is made and what the institutions of government can and cannot do, and also contains the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and Aboriginal rights. But even more so, to me, Canadians should care about the Constitution because the Constitution is the story of all of us. It's the story of how Canada was created. It's also the story of our aspirations. And it's the story of what we hope our country and our society can be. And we all own our Constitution. I don't think that the Constitution is simply the property or the exclusive domain of lawyers or law students or law professors or judges. I think it belongs to the Canadian people. It certainly does belong to the Canadian people, and I think that every citizen has the right to take ownership of the Constitution and contribute to the debate about the society that we want to have here in Canada.
I think that's a very interesting perspective to sort of look at how it applies to all Canadians, because it's something, you know, I don't know if everyone necessarily thinks of it that way, but to really actually think of it as something that represents Canadians that aren't just law students, lawyers, professors.
Yeah, I mean, people think that people tend to think in Canada as compared to the U.S., where every, you know, man, woman, and child can quote sections of the U.S. Constitution, the Second Amendment right to arms, the Fifth Amendment, you know, right to remain silent. In Canada, we tend to think that, oh, our Constitution is boring, that's for politicians and judges. And, you know, again, I think nothing is further than the truth. I think that the stories, our constitutional stories, our history is incredibly interesting, dating from, you know, from the Persons case in 1929 that recognized women as persons under our Constitution, to battles going on to this very day about Indigenous rights and about, I was chuckling because I wasn't thinking about Indigenous rights, I was thinking about beer and a case going to the Supreme Court of Canada from New Brunswick called Como about the right to import beer, which is perhaps not as lofty an issue as the future of Indigenous rights, but is maybe more a day-to-day concern, certainly for people in New Brunswick, but people across Canada.
Right, absolutely. So I guess our second question then would be, building off that, the focus of constitutional debate has changed a lot over the past 150 years. So early constitutional jurisprudence focused on the division of powers and the notion of watertight compartments. But more recently, the Supreme Court of Canada has considerably interpreted the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So what do you think are the next major constitutional interpretation trends?
Well, I think what we've seen, as you've articulated, is setting out the boundaries or the basic doctrine in the interpretation of rights in different areas and division of powers over the course of the last 150 years. I think what we're starting to see now, especially in the Charter era, 35 years in from the enactment of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms in 1982, instead of asking questions like what does freedom of religion mean, what does freedom of expression protect, we're seeing more and more the clash of rights. How do these provisions interact with each other? How does equality interact with freedom of religion? So we're seeing cases involving the clash of rights. Trinity Western University is about the clash of freedom of religion and freedom of and equality. We're seeing a case that was heard this past month at the Supreme Court involving a lawyer from Toronto named Joe Groya, which is a clash between rights of freedom of expression, the right of an accused to full answer and defense, to defend themselves in a criminal trial. We're seeing cases involving Indigenous rights and other aspects of the Constitution. And those, I think, are harder issues, and I think they're really interesting issues. In terms of building on Indigenous rights, I think that the biggest challenge going forward for the Supreme Court and for our society is reconciliation. And the Supreme Court in the last 20 years has made a lot of statements about reconciliation. The challenge is, how do you operationalize that? How do you operationalize that in law, and how do you operationalize that and actualize that in society?
Right. That makes a lot of sense, because mm-hmm. I think it's one thing to, you know, discuss reconciliation and say, you know, it is necessary moving forward, but it's another to actually implement that and see what does that really look like, you know?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And keeping in line with the discussion of the Supreme Court, the 150th anniversary of Confederation coincides with the departure of Chief Justice McLaughlin from the Supreme Court of Canada this December. So the Chief Justice will be retiring after nearly 20 years, as we know. And in that time, she's contributed significantly to Canadian constitutional law. Are there any overarching trends that you've noticed, other than you've mentioned, that the McLaughlin Court has set out?
Well, I think, first of all, there's a tendency when we're sort of close to events to maybe exaggerate their significance. And so when we were close to Chief Justice McLaughlin, for many of us, she's the only Chief Justice that we've known,
right.
And she's been the Chief Justice for, will be 18 full years. There might be a tendency to exaggerate her significance. Mm-hmm. I actually don't think that's the case. I think that she will likely go down in, I'm not sure that in 10 years we will look back and think that she was less influential than we think she was today. I think that she will go down in history as one of our most influential chief justices. We'll put in a plug for a conference that we're holding in April 2018 with partnership with the Ottawa Law Review about the legacy and the influence of Chief Justice McLaughlin. But I think when part of the thing that she has done, which you don't really see externally, is building consensus within the Supreme Court. And it's important for Canadians and for the legal community that the Supreme Court speak clearly on issues. And when she took over in January 2000, the court that she took over had been deeply fractured for a decade. As any law students who read Supreme Court decisions from the 1990s knows, when you're reading the decision in equality cases like Egan, that where there are three or four different decisions, the case is 80, 90, 100 pages, The court was very divided. Not only is that difficult for law students who are assigned to read that, that's difficult for lawyers and Canadians to understand their rights. Chief Justice McLaughlin succeeded in creating consensus within the court, having the court speak on in a clear voice on a number of issues. And I think when we will be able, with some hindsight, to divide her very long tenure into different periods. And I think if you look at the first decade, or the first half of her tenure as Chief Justice, up until about 2008, it was a period of consolidation, a period of trying to, whether by design or effect, trying to protect the court, trying to strengthen the position of the court after a decade of political attacks for judicial activism, trying to speak a little bit more clearly in a number of areas. And after that period of creating, I guess, strengthening the legitimacy of the court, what you saw post-2008 was a willingness on behalf of the Chief Justice and the members of her court to wade into more contentious public policy issues. So in decisions like Bedford on the legalization of prostitution, or decisions like Carter striking down as unconstitutional restrictions on physician-assisted suicide, it is very hard to imagine those decisions in the first half of the McLaughlin court. And those decisions, as many listeners will know, overturned precedents from previous courts. What those decisions, in a way, ushered in or responded to social change in Canadian society. Legalizing physician-assisted dying or legalizing prostitution are matters that involve great, great social change. The legalization of same-sex marriage in the court in 2004. Those are big issues of social change that the Supreme Court has been involved with. I think paradoxically, the court's involvement in those areas has perhaps been easier than the court's attempt to change legal culture. And by that I mean, if we look at some of the most recent Supreme Court decisions in the matters of the administration of justice, decisions in the criminal justice sphere like Jordan on trial delay, or its equivalent in the civil justice sphere, Herniak, those are attempting to change legal culture. And in a sense, those things are not as big issues as prostitution or physician-assisted dying or same-sex marriage. But I think those things have turned out to be much, much harder to change and a much bigger challenge for the Supreme Court as the leader of the legal system and the legal leader of the judicial system than in those other areas of social policy. And so my last point about the McLaughlin Court, which will be very much an open question, is the McLaughlin Court, I think, was the first Supreme Court to take reconciliation seriously, to really, in its statements, accept the legitimacy of Indigenous peoples as founding peoples of Canada, as the first peoples of Canada, and whose perspectives are constitutionally recognized, whose rights are constitutionally recognized. The challenge for Chief Justice McLaughlin's successor, as we've already touched upon, will be how do you breathe life into those statements and assertions?
Very interesting. So our next question then, I guess you sort of touched on already, but Canada 150 has been praised by many and criticized by others. And so it's sort of been viewed as an opportunity for celebration, but also sober reflection. So I don't know if you could explain a few more of the controversies surrounding the 150.
Yeah, I thought that, when you told me about this question, I thought I reflected more on this question probably than any other. And I thought this was a great question. And I think that birthdays or anniversaries are often, you know, there's a cake celebration, but there's also an opportunity for reflection. Not all birthdays people want to celebrate. People have different perspectives on their 30th birthday or their 40th or their 50th birthday, etc. So there's a lot of Canada 150 that is worthy of celebration and is an opportunity for celebration. But there are other aspects that make for pause for sober reflection and self-criticism. And so if we think about, to me, when I think about Canada 150, I think about I don't necessarily think about 1867. I think about the path predating 1867 and 1867 as the beginning of an ongoing dialogue. That's what a constitution is to me. It's a living dialogue. So obviously in 1867, if we think about the Fathers of Confederation, just of that term, that's a gendered term. It excluded women. There were no women formally involved in Confederation. Indigenous peoples were totally excluded. There were no religious minorities, etc. But if we think about the process as a developmental one of change since 1867, we see a process, to me, our constitutional history and our history in Canada is one of more and more inclusion. Recognition of different Canadians as citizens, as worthy of equal respect and participation in Canadian society. And so when I think about 1867 and then 1982, to me, one of the big impacts in our Constitution 150 project, we used three themes: Confederation, 1867, Patriation, 1982, and Reconciliation, which we would see as 2017, you know, dot, 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 continuing. And so to me, when we look at Canada 150 and look at different hallmarks or different events, I look at 1982 as a big event with not just the Patriation of the Constitution, but the recognition and the participation of other groups in the making of our Constitution in a way that recognized their legitimacy for the first time. Women's groups, religious minorities, other citizens' groups, and especially Indigenous Canadians. So I think I understand why some groups and certainly Indigenous Canadians might be very critical of not seeing a lot to celebrate in Canada 150. I think that's completely a legitimate perspective. And I think that we can learn from that, and we would be wrong just to look at Canada 150 as just about cake and fireworks. It's an opportunity to celebrate our successes, our advances, but it would be a lost opportunity if we didn't reflect upon the mistakes and the abuses that have occurred in those 150 years and take the opportunity to ask ourselves, what should we be working on now?
Okay. I find it really interesting the way that you describe these issues, not only from a legal perspective, but from a social change and culture and policy perspective. I think that's really important to identify and develop both sides of that narrative. And that does lead into our next question very well. We want to switch gears and discuss your other area of expertise, which is legal ethics. And so, of course, this is an important area for lawyers in a professional landscape that continues to undergo rapid change. So can you tell us about some of your most recent research in that area?
Sure. Well, coming out in the Alberta Law Review in early 2018, I've got an article that I worked on for a couple of years with Emily Alderson, who's a graduate of the law faculty and is now working at the Department of Justice at Fisheries and Oceans. And we spent a couple of years looking at the way that law societies traditionally regulate lawyers. And the way that they do it is, for the most part, and we're seeing some change, has been, well, they sort of wait until there's a complaint against lawyers, and then they investigate that complaint. It's a very reactive form of regulation, and it's traditionally how many regulatory bodies used to operate. But many regulatory bodies, really since early 2000s, started changing the way they regulated. And in the last decade, something called risk regulation has been much more popular. And the idea of risk regulation is you identify what the objectives of your regulatory body are, you identify what the risks are to that, and you then focus on addressing or hopefully preventing those risks. And so our article talks about some efforts that have been made in this respect in other professions and in the regulation of lawyers in other jurisdictions and in places in Canada, like Nova Scotia and other jurisdictions, but particularly Nova Scotia. And we argue that law societies should move to that model. And to be specific, what we mean is, well, what are your objectives? What are you trying to... The law societies are supposed to regulate in the public interest. That's a really amorphous term. Nobody really can define what the public interest means. And we argue that law societies should focus on protecting clients, protecting the public. Those are their overriding goals, and that they should identify what are risks to the public, what are risks to clients, and also, I think, what are risks to colleagues and people that lawyers interact with. And so for me, when one of the examples I give, I talked about Joe Groya before, and I've written about civility. I think that in 20 years, if not sooner, when we look back on law society regulation in the 2000s and the 2010s, people will ask themselves, why were law societies fixated on this idea of civility, of lawyers behaving rudely? Why did they spend so much money and time chasing after this one lawyer in Toronto who no client or no other lawyer ever brought a complaint against? What was the risk? What is the damage to his clients or other clients? What were the damage to the public? I hope that we have time to talk about access to justice, but instead of focusing on access to justice, which I think is an important issue, the law societies were focused on this idea of civility. And again, I think on a very narrow, almost 19th century patriarchal vision of civility. I would like to see the law society focus on a different sort of civility, which is a problem that as a professor and as a member of the legal profession I see, which is how lawyers treat their junior colleagues, how they treat especially younger women in the profession, how they treat their staff. To me, that's a serious problem of incivility, but that's not what law societies have been focused on.
So do you think that's more this focus on civility in sort of the 19th, 20th century patriarchal sense is sort of because it hits the public eye more, and that's as a self-regulatory body, maybe the law societies are more concerned with sort of being seen to properly manage and address issues that appear to be controversial? Or
that's a great question. That's sort of worthy of, I don't know if you're planning graduate work, but that would be a great master's thesis for you or any of the listeners. I'm not sure. It requires some much sort of deeper sociological analysis as to why the law society is fixated on these. I don't think it's because of the public nature of these, because again, when you talk about what clients are concerned about, much more down-to-earth matters. Clients tend to be are concerned about, are their lawyers doing a good job? Are their lawyers responding to their emails or returning their phone calls? Are they providing good client service? And this is much more about how lawyers are treating each other, which again, I'm more concerned about what I see as harassment, intimidation, and bullying within the legal profession, which we know goes on, which law societies have done very little to address because of the risk regulation problem. What articling student, what young female lawyer is going to complain to the law society about their principal, about a lawyer they're working with, or even a lawyer on the other side of the file? For all the reasons that we are reading about in the press about power imbalances and sexual harassment in the workplace, we know that everything is structured that makes it so hard for women and for vulnerable men to complain against these power abuses in the workplace. So why the Law Society has fixated on these things that at their highest level can really be acts of rudeness, I don't know. And again, part of my criticism of the Groya case from a regulatory perspective is the activity being complained about in the Groya case, all of it occurred in court before a judge. Right? This is not something that occurred in an office like the harassment and bullying that I'm talking about. It's in open court. There is a judge. There was a judge presiding. It is his responsibility. In that case, it was a male judge. His responsibility to manage the courtroom. Judges, lawyers are regulated, yes, by the Law Society, but if they're in court, they're officers of the court, and judges have the power to regulate them, and I think have the responsibility to regulate them. And if Joe Groya did something wrong in court, if any lawyer does something wrong in court that is rude, inappropriate, etc., then I would say it is incumbent upon the judge to address that misbehavior. Whether the Law Society should as well after the fact, that's an efficiency problem. Law Society's not there. The judge is there. You need to respond to negative behavior when it happens in front of you. And again, that's why, that's to me part of the problem with the whole incivility movement.
And Professor, on our level as well, as students about to enter the workforce, this legal workforce, how do you suggest that we inoculate ourselves against these types of issues?
That's an incredibly important incredibly important question. I wish that I had the answer or an answer to it. It's an issue for me that has become one of my top priorities, and I feel, you know, a responsibility is now somebody, you know, somewhat more at least more senior than you in the legal profession. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a responsibility on in the legal workplace. It's not the responsibility of when you ask how do you inoculate, it's not the responsibility of new or younger members of the profession who are entering the workplace to take responsibility that they are not subject to harassment or intimidation. It's not they are the victim of harassment, intimidation, or bullying. It is the responsibility of everyone in the workplace to make, and especially those in power, especially the partners, especially a managing partner, governing committees in a corporate workplace or in a government workplace, management, etc. It is their collective responsibility to make sure that there are supports in place for people in the workplace, for everyone in the workplace, and to do everything possible to make sure that bullies and harassers are not tolerated in the workplace. It is an unfortunate truth in the legal profession in this province and in this country, like in many other professions, that bullies and harassers are tolerated because they are seen to be powerful or bring in money. And that is in when you talk about the when you ask Alex about the you know the public image of things, I think that is incredibly short-sighted by those legal employers, because ultimately, whatever money they're bringing in is not worth the poisonous effect in the workplace and the risk of getting back to risk regulation. We're seeing right now the revelations in Hollywood and in other sectors, what that damage does to the brand of a company. And for law firms out there that have these people in their, in their offices, that risk, whatever money they're bringing in, that risk that they're holding on to, I don't think is worth whatever money those folks are bringing in. So what should the people in, the responsibility lies with people in power. For the advice that I would give graduates and new people entering the profession is, make sure that you have a support network. Talk to each other. Get together with each other. You are when somebody is a victim of harassment, bullying, discrimination, there may be a tendency to think that they are the only one in that position. They are the only one that has gone through that, either at that firm or generally. When you come together as a community, you realize that there are many shared experiences, and also that you are not alone, that there are people that you can go to for help and advice. There, in Ontario, there's a discrimination and harassment counselor that provides confidential advice. I think that the Law Society, the legal associations, and our law school need to do more to support new graduates, new entries into the legal profession. And that's where resources for regulation should go, and resources from legal associations.
So I guess that takes us into our last question then, and we've already kind of touched on it, but in an article from several years ago, An Education and Apprenticeship in Civility, you mentioned that access to justice is one of the main crises affecting the legal profession as opposed to civility. So do you think that remains true today? Should that be the priority of the law societies, of the profession in general? And if not, what has changed?
Well, Alex, I wish I could tell you here in 2017 that my talks about crisis, my writing about crisis, the access to justice crisis in 2011 or 2012, whenever I wrote that article, are historic and have been addressed. But I don't think that's the case at all. I'm not sure how much progress we've made in terms of the access to justice crisis in the last 5 years. The only progress I think we've made is a greater recognition that there is a crisis, but actually addressing that crisis is really hard. And I think part of the great difficulty is there needs to be more of a recognition that we in the legal profession, and that means everyone in the legal profession, from the law schools to the judges to the lawyers to government, we're part of the problem. And that's the first step to realizing that the solution's not going to, there's a tendency to look to others for the solution. The solution's not going to come from government, dropping $1 billion into the legal system. There's a tendency to sort of view that, oh, if only government gave more money. No, we're in this together. We have created this problem. And ultimately, in terms, Canadians are going to hold us accountable, and rightly so. So again, they are going to, to me, I've said this for years, that I've seen the greatest threat to self-regulation in the legal profession being access to justice, not being rogue lawyers or civility or something. Now, law societies aren't necessarily directly responsible for the administration of the courts, obviously, or the legal system. They're increasingly recognized that either if it's part of their statutory mandate, like the Law Society of Ontario, formerly known as the Law Society of Upper Canada, or even if it's not formally part of their statutory mandate, access to justice is a key aspect of their work and a key priority. And if you just, we need to get over our sort of fear of innovation in the legal system. And if you just look, some of the best writing about access to justice in North America talks about needing to adopt a user approach to the justice system. We've tended to create a justice system that works for lawyers and judges, but it doesn't work for the people that are actually using the justice system. And so our justice system looks very much like how banking was when I was a little kid growing up in the 70s. When I was a kid growing up in the 70s, banks were open. There was something called banker's hours, which looks very much like how court hours are. Banks were open Monday to Friday, 10 to 4. And then they started opening Thursday night, late. And you could only bank at one bank, at your home branch. And then they opened interbranch banking. And then they opened, then there was the ATM. Then there's telephone banking. Now, of course, you can bank, you know, on your mobile phone. Compare that to the justice system. Our justice system looks like banking in the 1970s. And we need to change it to respond to the needs of the users. And we need to do that quickly, not over the course of the next 30 years, really over the course of the next decade, or else we really risk losing the confidence of the public in our justice system.
Okay. Thank you so much for your thoughtful insight today, Professor. We've really enjoyed hearing your thoughts about these issues, and we look forward to speaking with you again. So on behalf of the Ottawa Law Review, we'd once again like to thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much. It's been a real honor to be here today, and a special honor to be your inaugural interviewee as part of this great series that I look forward to listening to.
Everyone stay tuned for upcoming episodes, and remember to follow the OLR on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. Thanks very much.